Nearly 12 years ago, Cardinal Pell rang me and said, "Oh, Peter, I'd like you to do something for me. I'd like you to take over the Justice and Peace Office for 6 months." 12 years ago. And at that time, he said, "Well, if you could just do maybe a couple of days a week, but don't worry, you've got some help. There's a lady who works in the office for a few hours one day a week." Fantastic. Now we have five of us working. So, and I won't tell you the stealth by which I've managed to achieve
Thank
that. I think for all of us, this is a challenging space to work in. And I think it can also be a frustrating space to work in. Because when I think of being social justice groups trying to achieve a different world, which we all have this wonderful vision of, we can feel frustrated that it doesn't happen. I've been praying for peace for a long time now, every single morning and every single night of my life. And we have 55 nation states at war at the moment. So, Peter, your prayers are going really well here at home. And we can feel a sense of frustration. So I'd like to begin by telling you a somewhat personal story. I've been a priest now for 39 years in a few weeks. And I can remember going through a particularly tough time. I was thinking, what am I doing? Really? Am I achieving anything? Yada, yada, yada. We all go through those things in our lives. And I spoke to a friend of mine, a guy who's been a very good friend, a mentor, and spiritual advisor, and a whole lot of things. And I said to him, he's 20 years older than me. And I said, "How have you done it? How do you keep going in this church?" He said, "Well, you know, sometimes I think that maybe sometime in some place for someone, I've made a difference." And I thought, that's right. That's enough. And I think that's something about what it means to work in this justice and peace and social justice space too. We haven't brought peace to the world yet. We haven't brought justice yet, but we keep plugging on and we make a difference. And when people ask me, what do you like about working in this space? I always say it's the relationships that I've built, the people that I've met. And the wonderful people all across this diocese and other dioceses who are all doing their little bit to make a better world. That's working. It is working. And I think about those prayers of peace that I say every morning and every evening of my life. They haven't brought peace to the world, but I hope they're changing me and making me a more ironic, more peaceful person. So what I wanted to talk to you today about is probably one of the frustrations that we experience, and it's the tension between charity and justice. When new social justice groups are established in our diocese or anywhere, the first thing that people are asking, and quite necessarily, is what can we do? And what normally happens is that people jump to doing something charitable. And there is a distinction between charity and justice. When we think about charity, it's about giving to an immediate need. It's about helping somebody who's right in front of us and has a need right now. And we solve that person or that group's immediate need. Now, for that person or group, it might be ongoing, so try to meet that need. Justice is about trying to look behind that and say, why is that person in need? What are the systemic problems in our world that are causing that? And how perhaps can we help address that? You know, the old saying, give a man a fish and he eats for the day. Teach a man to fish and he will feed himself for a lifetime. And that's what I think justice is about. We all know, I hope, it's a story Jesus told called The Good Samaritan. Have you ever heard of it? Oh, that's good. So we all know it's the story of the man who's traveling from Jerusalem down to Jericho. That road notoriously was dangerous. So this poor hapless fellow gets beaten up, robbed, and along comes our hero, the Samaritan, who has become so important. He's entered our dictionaries as being Good Samaritans. He rescues this man, takes him off to the inn, gives the innkeeper the money, look after him. It's a very, very charitable thing to do. I kind of extend that parable to what I call the parable of the excellent Samaritan. I apologise to those of you who have heard this story before, especially those from Leichhardt North Parish. And I think, what would it require to be a person of justice in that situation, not just the person of charity? Well, you would try to change that road, wouldn't you? You try to not just fix that immediate person's problem. So you'd go to the police and ask them for more patrols on the road between Jerusalem and Jericho. Perhaps you'd put in more street lighting along the road between Jerusalem and Jericho. Perhaps you would think about warning people about the dangers of this road. You see the difference. Hopefully, those actions might help not to make that road such a dangerous place. Charity alleviates the immediate need, while justice asks for what are the systemic issues causing the need. We look at homelessness, for example, in our city, and the first thing that people say that will cure homelessness is give somebody somewhere to live. And I can tell you that does not work. That is not the solution to homelessness. The solution to homelessness is saying, why is this person on the street? It's what in the In Street Sleeping Task Force we call turning off the taps. In other words, is it about mental illness? Is it about marital breakup? And especially for older women now, which is the most increasing number of people who are homeless now, is it because of financial difficulties? Is it because of violence? All those kind of things. So let's look behind the person who's in front of us on the street and say, why is this person there? One of the reasons why giving those people a home doesn't work is because one of the issues is you don't give them a community with it. And people need to be supported to have community and to have support. And often they need the support of mental health issues, doctors, medicine, all those kinds of things. They're the things that are about looking behind it and how do we stop homelessness in our city, not by giving people a home, by stopping them being on the streets to start with. I'd like to pick up on perhaps a more modern example of my excellent Samaritan story. Yesterday was the 25th anniversary of the Timorese vote for independence. And Susan, it's wonderful to have you with us here today. Susan Connolly and Josie and some of the others have just done such fabulous work up in East Timor with those wonderful Timorese people. They have been bringing justice there. When I thought about what's going on in Timor, if it was me, I would have thought, I know what I can do. I can raise some money, help those people by giving them money. Maybe the kids need education. I can get a group of teachers from Australia to go in there, teach them. That's not what the Sisters of St. Joseph did. They had a different model. They tried to teach them to teach themselves. And so the Sisters of St. Joseph and that network have, over time, been training teachers, training in language, giving them resources, books in the Tetan language, and a whole lot of other things that I'm sure Susan can describe. But behind that also has been advocacy with the Australian government to try and get a better deal for the people of Timor-Leste. And so, in other words, I don't think that charity is wrong. It's absolutely necessary and prime, but it's not the only thing, is it? It requires what's behind it to try and turn off the taps, to bring a more just world. I think that in our social justice groups, too, in our own parishes, it's good to reflect about this. We're doing this in the office all the time, saying, you know, are we just putting band-aids on problems in our society, or are we trying to ameliorate the actual problem that is causing what requires the band-aids? I'd like to give you another example, which when I was in the parish of Lemire, we were listening to the people in our community about what were their issues. One of the things that just kept resurfacing was older people were finding it hard to access medical care. Now, As you know, in the Liverpool area, there's an enormous big hospital, but around it are so many different medical centres, and people were finding it hard to get there. They could get an appointment, but there was no parking. It was always difficult. And so I thought, oh, I know what we can do. We can get a bus and we can help drop these people off at the medical centres. Well, that is not going to work because their appointments are all at different times. So I got some of those people, and more to the point, their carers together. And said, what would actually help you with this problem of the medical centers? And I said, well, all we really need is a little drop-off center outside those medical centers. Well, sounds a reasonably simple enough thing to do. Went to the council and said, could you do that? I said, oh no, that's very difficult because we need that parking for all day for people who are commuters and so on. Not to be deterred, the council elections were coming up, which was very helpful. So we invited all the councillors to, and those who were standing for election, to come along to a meeting in the parish. And we got people to stand up and tell their stories. And then I said to each one of them, I said, you've heard these stories. You know it's an issue in the LGA. If you're elected, will you put drop-off zones in front of the medical centres? And every one of them, bar one, said, oh, yes, of course. Yes, we'll do that. And I said, good, we had about 200 people in the hall, I might add, not just our Catholic community, people from all sorts of different areas of life. I said, that's great because we're all coming to the first council meeting after the election. After their faces had stopped turning ashen, they said, oh, well, that'll be all right. The first point on the agenda was drop-off zones in front of medical centres in the LGA. In other words, trying to get behind the problem and see what can solve it, and who indeed is the problem who's stopping it. Political power is often difficult to achieve because when we think of our politicians, they have these huge agendas. They've got all sorts of things. But I can tell you that the number one thing on every single politician's mind is getting back in the next election. Now, if they think there is a massive swing against them and it's going to have a political backlash, you watch how fast they move. When I first arrive in any parish, the very first thing I do is make an appointment to see the mayor, the state member, and the federal member. I did that when I came to this parish nearly 12 years ago. I'm great friends with the mayor, and we've cooperated on a number of ventures, including opening a refugee welcome centre down there in Lilyfield. He rings me every so often and says, oh, Peter, can you help me out with this? And I say, sure, no problem, Darcy. By the way, while I've got you on the phone, our federal member's name is Anthony. Very handy to have the Prime Minister as the local member on the Monday. Because Albo wasn't the Prime Minister when I arrived here, and we had a number of discussions. In fact, I can remember the very first one we sat down and said to him, so what are your values? What's important to you, Anthony? And he said, well, to be honest, Peter, he said, I'm like most Catholics. He said, there are three things. He said, the Labor Party, the Catholic Church and South Sydney. This time, South Sydney were going through some turmoil. And I said, oh, Labor Party, Catholic Church, and South. I said, how's that going for you? And he said, well, look, I probably don't go to Mass as much as I should. He said, but I am a cradle Catholic and I still support the Catholic Church. And he went on and on. So thanks for that, Anthony, but I was more interested in what you think about South Sydney. So I think that having contact with our local members is so important, whether they happen to be, was he the Prime Minister, obviously less access to him now, but knowing our politicians is important. And knowing, and I think this is important, that we are not coming to him just as individuals, but we come representing our parish. We come representing a large body of people who are concerned about issues that affect the local community. And as Julie said, you make an appointment and you're one of the voters, they will listen to you They may not agree, they may not do it, but they will give you a hearing. I think that's important.
Peter, just on that point, you're the parish priest. Are you suggesting that we have that right as well?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, because I only get one vote.
Yeah.
So do you. But you go along and say, oh, look, I represent the social justice group in my parish, and we are concerned about...
Okay.
Yeah. But I think one of the things to me that's been important is when I've met each one of those people, local, state, federal, has been not to go and meet them and say, hi, I'm the parish priest of St. Columbus. This is what you should be doing, because that just gets people offside, doesn't it? I've gone along and said, I wanted to meet with you because I wanted to know who our local representative is. I've just moved in and I'm settling into this community and build a relationship with them. And over time, things grow. If you've got a relationship, then you've got more chance of them listening to you. Now, I'm not saying you go and visit your federal member every week or every month or even every year, but that you go to meet them and that they're aware that you are representing your parish. Your parish represents a large number of people in their electorate. We talked earlier about the social justice document for this year, and I think it's a great document. One of the things that I find in my experience, and one of the things that I challenge myself on all the time, is to be able to call out lies. We talked about how the truth is so important to building trust, and trust builds peace. Well, if that's the case, somehow, as we step back in that progression, we should call out the lies, the misinformation, the disinformation. Now, we can't always do that on a big, wide scale, but I've found there's been lots of opportunities in very simple ways to do that with people. I've been kind of in groups at dinner or something like that, and somebody says something quite outrageous. Just after the referendum, I was at a gathering of a number of people, we were just having dinner together, and somebody said, well, of course, that referendum is bound to fail, because why should we be listening to the voices of the Aboriginals without listening to everybody else's voices? And I was sitting three or four people away from him, and I was about to stand up and leap down his throat in a very gentle, loving way. And a young teenage girl beat me to it. But she said, that's a load of nonsense. How can you possibly think that? And she took him on. And I thought, good on you, girl. Well done. But I think sometimes we become timid because, you know, we're Christians, aren't we? We're loving people. We don't call out other people. And yet I think Jesus was a person who said we must speak the truth. And we speak it with bravery, but with kindness and with love. I mean, it doesn't mean that it has to be something that is totally not recognising other people's perspective. We do need to listen, but we don't need to accept the misinformation, the disinformation. That's how we end up in a state where our nation voted 60% not to listen to our Indigenous sisters and brothers. And I heard people say, I don't know what it's about, so I'm not voting yes. I'm not terribly bright, but there seems to be, well, why don't you find out? Anyhow, let's move on from that, or I will rant more. One of the other things that's come up this morning as we've been talking, is the church and its relationship with politics. Has anybody ever said to you, the church should stay out of politics? That's not the place of the church. Somebody actually mentioned that it was some pushback in their own parish about having a social justice group. Wow. During COVID, the Archbishop asked if I would give a talk to all the priests of Sydney about social justice and Catholic social teaching. John Paul II said, Catholic social teaching is the best kept secret in the church. And Anthony Fisher asked me if I would try and reveal that secret to the rest of the priests. And what would change somebody's mind about whether the church should be involved in politics or not? Well, to me, same thing that changes my mind about lots of things, and it's reading the gospel, the life of Jesus. Why was Jesus crucified? Well, this odd theology that we've had for some years was that it was a sense of atonement, that God wanted Jesus to die because we're all sinners, and if God's son Jesus died, then that would fix all of that up. Now, I don't know what that says about God, but it says we've got some very bad theologians in the church. Jesus died essentially because he was a political animal. Jesus was put to death because of the things that he said and did. The Gospels are certainly replete with incidents where Jesus addressed the proximate needs, that is, the charities of those he was confronted with, curing the sick, raising the dead to life, feeding the hungry, and so on. Perhaps, however, you have the poor with you always is a reminder that enacting any real systemic change is maybe beyond humanity, that what we can do is what's immediately in front of us. However, we have depoliticized the life of Jesus to the point where he's become merely a religious figure. This presumes, I think, a modern Western assumption that religion is separate from politics and economics, an assumption that was not possible in first century Judea. Let's just think about one incident, the cleansing of the temple. That is one of the only stories that appears in all four of the Gospels. So I think the truth of it is undeniable. But we've begun to see it as Jesus heading up to the temple and goes, wow, what's going on here today? They're having a carnival. We can't have that inside the temple. And he gets cranky and dries them all out. That is not what happened at all. This was not a one-off event in the temple. This was a continual abuse of the temple area. Jesus was not just railing against the house being desecrated, the house of God. He was railing against the politics of the time. And the politics of the time was that they were changing money there from the Roman currency, which was used in everyday life, to the temple currency, which was used to make offerings inside. In other words, it was about the Roman occupation. It was also about how the Jewish leaders allowed all of this to happen. It was also about how politically they were oppressing the poor because they were extorting money from them to be able to go and make those donations. This is not a religious event alone. It was a political one. Jesus was effectively blocking the normal operations integral to, not a corruption of, the function of the religious political economy of the temple, such as money changing and the selling of doves. Given the temple and the high priesthood were the centre of political, economic, as well as Judean religious life, it's difficult to restrict the interpretation of Jesus' actions to mere religious zeal. Back to the crucifixion for a moment. Jesus was crucified as a thief and a brigand. Crucifixion was obviously painful. It was also very public. The bodies of those who were crucified were always left on the cross, sometimes permanently, and carrion would come and feed on the bodies hanging on the cross. That's why Joseph Arimathea has to go and say, look, the Passover's coming. Do you mind if we please take down the body of Jesus? This was an obvious statement. He was crucified between two thieves, two brigands. It's hard to imagine that, well, let's put this religious figure in the middle and two brigands on the other side. No, This was a political action. And we can see that political action also in the way that Jesus was bounced backwards and forwards between the Romans and the Jewish leaders. And eventually it was them feeding the people to say, let's get rid of this man. But public opinion against Jesus was nurtured, we learn in Mark's gospel, only from verse 2, right at the start. Political opinion starts to rise against Jesus. It's only in, I think, Mark 2 that they say they looked for an opportunity to do away with him. And that was because he cured someone on the Sabbath. Jesus continually did things that put the political leaders at the time offside. And that alignment between church and state was never a distinction in that first century in Judea. So back to us. Should we be political? I say, well, what does it mean to be political? Clearly the church and us cannot be party political. We can't stand up in front of our church or in our bulletins and say, vote for the Greens, vote for the Teals, vote for this one or vote for that one. But that's not what I mean by politics. Politics, of course, comes originally from Socrates, the polis, the state. And Aristotle creates the term politics, as in the care of the state, the care of the community. Now, if we are not concerned with the care and the well-being of the community, what are we doing as a church? If we're not concerned about injustice, we've missed the whole message of the gospel. And so I believe that it is incumbent on all of us to be charitable, to meet the needs of immediate problems in front of us, whether it be feeding the hungry, clothing the poor, and so forth. And we as a church are really good at that. However, we're not so good at looking behind it to say, how do we create systemic change to stop us having to feed the poor, to ensure that people have got housing, to ensure that refugees are cared for, to ensure that this becomes a better society? That's what Jesus did, got him crucified. That's what we keep doing, and there comes pushback. We're called Marxists. Oh, well. Not for one moment decrying the need for charity. Of course, we have to have charity. We have to have concern for the immediate problems of our society, how we help feed, clothe, and nourish those who are struggling, how we help find places of refuge for those in need. But we also need to be challenging why those exist in our society. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So when you get pushback in your parishes about, oh, why, we've got a social justice group, you guys are just all political, say thank you and point them to the Gospels. But I think it's often too a challenge for some of our church authorities as well. Some of our bishops are very good at things that they think are prime on the agenda. But I'd love to see the bishop's voice, the bishops, as in the bishop's conference, much more vocal, much more political, much more putting themselves out, speaking the truth. Not asking the bishops to become highly political. But it seems to me that over time, now I'm going to be political, that the two federal parties, the main two parties, have just come closer and closer together. What I call the politics of the beach. If you want to sell ice creams on a beach, where do you set up? Right in the middle, because then people from both ends of the beach can access the ice creams in the middle of the beach. Is that what you do? Right. If you wanted to compete with them, where would you set up? Right beside them, of course. If you set up halfway down the beach this side, you're only attracting that part. And I think that's what our political parties are doing. And so they just seem so much in lockstep now. It's very difficult to see a distinction. I think that as we become a voice, we can challenge that. You know, the church in centuries past was the voice of society. And yet, religious people are still a huge number in this country. we still have a political voice if we can begin to create that solidarity that makes a block of people who can indeed challenge governments at all levels to say, hey, this is what we think, this is what Christians believe. If you're not going to do that, you're probably going to be voted out in the next election. But that consensus seems to be harder and harder to achieve. And so we keep working away in our own little groups. We keep picking away. We keep doing our charitable work, which I think is really important. But we also look behind it to say, well, what can we achieve? What is possible? There is an adage that says, you know, you don't take on a fight that you can't win. But the challenge to me often is, what does winning actually mean? I can't win the fight of getting peace in the world. Well, I'm just going to stop praying. No, because there are other byproducts of that, my own peacefulness, the way in which it helped me to realise the need for peace in our world. My putting solar panels on the roof of the church and presbytery and on this building here somehow are not going to stop climate change, but they are a contributing factor. And also it's about the awareness of every single person who drives along Elswick Street here who looks and sees this massive panels across the top of our school and says, wow, the Catholic Church is actually interested in trying to make a more just society, about trying to do something about climate change. Every time we plant a tree, every time we do the small things, every little bit chips away. Just finally, I just want to say thank you for the work that you do. Because as I said right at the start, it can be frustrating. It can be a struggle. And yet I believe it's a struggle that's worth continuing with to pursue, because we do make a difference. We do make a difference. And the difference begins, I think, with ourselves. That helps us to be different, more just and more focused people on the teachings of the gospel. And then I think that spreads. That spreads. I like to think that there is a kind of snowball effect. But each time we're at a dinner party and we challenge somebody who has something to say that appears to be against justice, that supports some crazy, misspoken idea that we challenge, it's perhaps made another person think about their attitude. Maybe when they change their mind, if they change their mind, they're going to talk to other people. That's how notions and ideas spread through our world. One Jewish man 2,000 years ago changed the face of this planet.